Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Ballot Box. So we've got a big Latin American, an Andean special for this week. Two elections, one second round, one first round of presidential and congressional elections in Peru and in Ecuador as well. You may remember that we already talked about the first round of the Ecuadorian elections a couple of months ago. You can find that episode in the archives. I think it's called Ecuador and Liechtenstein. And so give that a listen if you want some more of the kind of background to that election.
And we also talked a bit about Peru in our State of 2020 election podcast. Mm-hmm. When Andreas was talking about elections that he was looking forward to this year, mm-hmm. Peru was one of the ones that he was most anticipating because of events that have happened in the previous 5 years.
Okay, so we're going to get into these two elections. I think we're going to tackle Peru first, and then we will we'll take a look at the second round of the Ecuadorian election, which I think was somewhat of a surprise to all of us, what happened in that one. But yeah, before we get going, how is everyone? How are you, Andres, in Mexico?
I'm good, thank you. I've been thinking of logos and potential slogans for our podcast. So I think we had some banter over text messages, and I think we put the party in party politics emerged as the winner of our possible slogans.
Well, that's a great use of your time, I think. Not much else to do these days anyway, so yeah, definitely good use of your energies. All right, how about you, Chris? How's things in Manchester?
Oh, pubs and shops are open again, albeit. So I've been enjoying that with my lovely partner. And the weather has actually been pretty pleasant this weekend. So that means that it's actually nice to go outside, which is also an advantage.
Yeah, well, we've been much the same down here. It's been really nice to have a little bit of normality back. We've been able to go out, enjoy ourselves and see some people we haven't seen for a while as well. So yeah, it's been quite a pleasant week, to be honest. All right, so let's move on to Peru, I think, which has held the first round of presidential elections and the elections to the Congress of the Republic, the Peruvian legislature. This was a fractious election. Lots of different candidates, none of them winning particularly high shares of the vote. We do have two candidates now progressing forward to the runoff. Do you want to tell us, Andres, quickly what the kind of main takeaways are from this election first?
Sure. This election held last week on April 11th was actually the main headline that it produced was the shock that this relatively unknown candidate would emerge to first place. His name is Pedro Castillo. And as you said, none of the candidates won a particularly large share of the vote, but he ended up in top spot with 16%. I think that it's a real shock because he hasn't held elected office before in his life. He wasn't very well known. Opinion polls before the last week of campaigning put him quite low at around 6 or 7%, and he just ended up opinion polls in the last week of the election did notice an uptick, but still, you know, a big surprise. The second headline, although not surprising, is that the daughter of the hugely polarizing authoritarian leader of Peru's past, Alberto Fujimori, his daughter, Keiko Fujimori, has ended up in second place, which means that she'll be part of the runoff. Not so much of a shock, but still a headline, partially because she's so controversial as her political career is tied to this authoritarian, very authoritarian period of Peru in the 90s. I guess the other election is just that the elections come at a really bad time for Peru. Like a lot of Latin American countries, Peru has been hit by the COVID-19 pandemic. terribly, and has one of the highest excess mortality rates in the world. So just one of the shocking statistics is that it Peru has had 2,610 deaths in excess per million, which means that it has about twice as many the excess deaths that the US suffered from last year. So it's twice as bad in terms of the mortality rate. Also terrible kind of economic crisis and downturn with a loss of 11% of its GDP over the last year. So those are kind of the headlines. So surprising and an election that's happening in a very bad context for the country.
So Peru has, in some ways, a fairly typical Latin American institutional setup, as a presidential system, use of the double ballot for the president. But Peru also has some kind of institutional quirks to it as well. Do you want to sort of briefly lay out what the institutional setup is in Peru and what exactly was up for election this time?
Sure. So what was up for election? It was the first round of presidential the presidency, and Peruvians elect the president along with two vice presidents. They also elected 130 congresspeople for the unicameral National Congress. So like Ecuador and Central American countries, Peru is unicameral. That is kind of an oddity in Latin America, because I think with the exception of Ecuador, Peru, Venezuela, and Central America, all of the rest of Latin America, so like the big countries in Latin America, mostly the ones with higher population, are bicameral systems. The other oddity, or one of the other oddities, peculiarities, is that it has Peruvians have to vote for two vice presidents. And so I looked into this, and the double vice president comes from an old constitution of the 19th century of 1860. And then the figure of vice president disappeared between 1920 and then did not reappear until the constitution that was approved under Fujimori in 1993 and set two vice presidents. Oddly enough, So presidential candidates have to name a first vice president and a second vice president. And to my knowledge, this is the only system in the world where there's two vice presidents and that appear on the ballot. Like, it's the only system that I know of where there are two vice presidents, period. The vice president is meant to kind of step in for the president when the president is on official tours outside the country. But it's actually been more important for when presidents get impeached, as they will become president in the order in which they appeared on the ballot. So like the first vice president, second vice president. And just to show how kind of convoluted, how much instability there's been in Peru in the last few years, two vice presidents were actually had to step into the seat of the president in the last recently, when PPK was impeached. His first vice president, Vizcarra, assumed power. We talked about this in the episode that was the 2021 preview. And then he was impeached, and so the second vice president had to take power. And then she declined taking the presidential office, but she had to make that call. So that's another peculiarity. I guess the third and most important peculiarity, and the one that's kind of one of the factors behind the enormous political instability, is that the Peruvian National Congress, which is this unicameral Congress, has a lot of powers for a presidential system. Mainly, I'd say its power consists, or what makes it stand apart from other unicameral systems, is that it can impeach the president relatively easily, and can impeach the president for something called moral incapacity, which doesn't require the president to have been, doesn't require proving that the president committed a crime or stepped outside the law, only that the president is morally incapable of holding office, whatever, you know. And that's kind of almost a subjective kind of evaluation. So it allows, it opens the door for a lot of politics to get in the way. And the parliament also has to approve of the president's cabinet. And if it does not approve, at least if it doesn't approve the president's cabinet on more than two occasions, by the third, the president can call snap elections for the Congress, which is extremely odd in presidential systems. Again, I don't know of any presidential system where there is this sort of figure that's borrowed from parliamentary systems of snap elections. Although this does happen only under the circumstance where there are more than two cabinet members which aren't approved by Congress. I guess I could also talk about the kind of constitutional setup for electing the Congress, which, because, you know, this election was not only the first round of presidential voting, it also was the congressional election. And so Congress is elected through a 27 multi-member constituency with open list proportional representation. There is a threshold of 5%, and the threshold, well, so the threshold is actually not only about the 5%. The threshold is also mixed. So there's a 5% threshold for the national vote per party in order to enter Congress. But if a party obtains at least or wins at least seven seats in any of the constituencies, it doesn't need to get the 5% vote at the national level to also pass through the threshold. So it's like a double, there's two standards for the threshold. An additional kind of curiosity is that each constituency has a variable number of congresspeople who it elects to parliament. And there are only two constituencies that have more than seven members. So the seven member threshold only applies for Lima. And I forgot the other, Lima, which is the largest constituency with, I think, 36 seats in Congress. And then a department in the north of the country that has exactly seven seats. Voters, in addition to being able to vote for a party on the ballot, can also vote for up to two specific candidates per constituency, but not more than two. And the threshold applies to both the candidates and the party, such that even a candidate that received an enormous amount of votes, if their party doesn't pass the threshold, will not be elected to Congress. So I think and obviously the presidential system is a runoff system. So the combination, I think, in my analysis, and I don't know if you guys agree with this, obviously there's lots of polarization in society. There's important fractures within Peruvian society, one of them being about the history of authoritarianism, but also it's about inequality, huge inequality, and very unequal development within the country. But the institutional setup is also such that it kind of exacerbates or translates social fractures into the institutional realm by creating kind of powerful Congress. And then the two-run system, the runoff system, also allows for fragmentation of the vote and for a discrepancy in the presidential vote versus the congressional makeup, which increases the possibility of a divided government. It actually makes a divided government extremely likely in a system where Congress is already very powerful vis-a-vis the presidency.
Yeah, I think on top of that, we should also mention that my understanding of Peru is that parties are not typically very socially rooted. And so there's a typically between elections, parties will sometimes move from being as high as the largest one to being all the way out of Congress. It's a very volatile political system and political society where you know there isn't a kind of typical largest left-wing party or a typical largest right-wing party, or albeit a little bit more on the right because of the Fujimori connection.
I think that's a really good point. And the fact that parties are not, they don't have such deep roots in society, they're not as institutionalized, allows for parties to be the vehicles of like particular politicians on many occasions. Some parties have been around for longer and they have some sort of institutional strength. And I'm thinking, for example, of Acción Popular, Popular Action, for example, but others are clearly the vehicle of individual politicians, or they can become so because they're not as rooted in society.
Yeah, no, it's an unusual kind of design, and I get why in very occasionally you'll hear it described as semi-presidential, which I don't think I would agree with, but you can sort of see why there are certain little aspects. I mean, there is also an office of prime minister in Peru, which is obviously very unusual for presidential systems. And obviously, as you say, there is the kind of, albeit a quite restricted ability to dissolve the legislature by the president as well. There's these kind of strange features. And as you say, it's not only is it a unicameral system, but this is a very big country in terms of population. It's about 33 million. And the legislature has 130 seats, which is a very small, very powerful body as well. And one which is incredibly fractured. I think at the last legislative election, the largest party only received about 10% of the vote, which just gives you a good idea of kind of how many different formations would be in a legislature typically, which is not really a great way to provide a stable majority for a presidential administration, definitely.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. I mean, the fragmentation is, last election was worse when it came, saw a much higher level of fragmentation for Congress. As you say, none of the parties got much more than 10% of the vote last election for Congress, which was crazy. So like the presidential system, I think one of the defining features of it is that it has very fixed terms, right? Very fixed mandates in time. And that's kind of how a lot of the incentives of the political system are structured. While in parliamentary system, there are terms, but there's much more flexibility to call like snap elections or, form new governments. So in Peru, you get the possibility of cutting term limits short vis-a-vis either the impeachment or dissolving parliament. But the culture of politics there conceives of this as a big taboo, actually. So, and it's a big shock for the system, even though the laws allow for a relatively make it much more likely than other presidential systems. And so we saw this in over 2020. There was a huge kind of political crisis, which we spoke about in our 2020 preview, but the kind of different components of the balance of power between Congress and presidency and fragmentation played out in that in last year, which is also another reason why I think there was the possibility of a kind of surprise from an outsider candidate, because people were, a lot of voters were extremely dissatisfied, disenchanted with the way that formal politics were being carried out in Peru.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth just underlining for those who didn't listen to the last podcast, but since the last presidential election in 2016, Peru has had 5 different presidents because of the process of constant impeachments and controversies and so on and so forth, which is clearly not an advertisement for political stability in Peru, and particularly in a period when the country has been hit hard by COVID and has had kind of poorly performing economy, is not helpful.
Yeah, and in the kind of the substratum, or not even the substratum, but the kind of the background to this also is the huge corruption scandal of Odebrecht, which was the first domino that hit the Peruvian political system, as it was in Brazil and so many other countries in Latin America, and led to the downfall of PPK, which then led to the downfall of his vice president and then the other vice president, and has even caught Keiko Fujimori, the runner-up of this first round of voting, who was imprisoned. She was in something called preventive prison. So like she hasn't been formally charged with money laundering or accepting bribes, but she's been in prison three times already, related to the Odebrecht scandal, as investigations go on. So that's also a huge part of why there's so much instability in Peru.
Yeah. All right. Maybe we should move on to discussing some of the kind of major candidates that were up for the presidency in this election. And I think, as you say, a lot of these candidates are quite closely linked to the parties as well, as a lot of the parties have become very kind of personality focused. So maybe it would kind of make sense to sort of start with the candidates and also talk about their parties alongside them as well. We could start with Pedro Castillo, who was the kind of unexpected first place candidate in this election. How would we kind of, if we were to place him on the in the kind of political spectrum, where would we locate Pedro Castillo?
I'd say in like the far left in economic terms, and probably very right in kind of social policy, social terms. His economic policies are very, I'd say they're very influenced by you know, left-wing ideologies of Latin America and during the Cold War in the 60s and 70s, which is about a lot of state intervention in the economy as a force of like redistribution and nationalization. But he's very conservative socially, which makes sense to a lot of voters in Latin America, actually. So he has been, he's made very openly kind of anti-pro-choice statements. And he's also made anti-same-sex marriage statements. So
I noticed also, briefly looking at the results, that Castillo is kind of the only candidate who actually has regionally very strong basis of support. So whereas the other candidates tend to be very split, and that although they have areas where they do better than others, I mean, there are no places where they're really predominant, but he actually has several regions where he's receiving over 50% of the vote, which is quite something considering that he only got 16% of the national vote. And these are mostly located in the kind of high Andes, sort of central bits of Peru. And I think we were talking a little bit about this before we came on air about Castillo's relationship with kind of indigenous identity in Peru as well. So I was wondering if you could kind of touch upon that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I think that's maybe in addition to his like economic policies, I think just the sort of persona that he has, the political persona that he has, which is, I think, also very authentic. I mean, he's not, this is the first time he's run for office, which is part of the shock, is what makes him an attractive candidate for a lot of people in Peru, especially those who feel left behind by traditional elites and by kind of institutional infighting. He is, you know, he's 51, he's a school teacher. He rose to prominence because he helped organize a teacher strike in 2017. He wears a wide-brimmed hat and dresses in the traditional clothing of Peruvian peasants, who are also mostly, who are mostly kind of influenced by indigenous culture. Not all of them would self-describe as indigenous, although a lot of them would. And Peru's indigenous population is quite big. It's not as large as that of Bolivia in proportional terms. But around 25% of people in Peru are of indigenous, are part of the like indigenous population. And most of them have some sort of level of fluency of one of the native languages. Pedro Castillo is also, he's a Quechua speaker, which definitely allows him to portray himself as an indigenous an indigenous candidate. Although in Peru, being a peasant, being a campesino, can sometimes double as considering oneself an indigenous person. So there's been studies around how kind of indigenous identity in Peru changed from being campesinos, which is more of a class-based kind of identity, to being indigenous, especially towards the 1990s and onwards, like after the kind of big economic shifts in Latin America, people were more likely to self-describe as indigenous. So he's definitely he's definitely a candidate that indigenous people can identify with, who are also the most downtrodden people of the country, the ones who've benefited less from international trade with China, which is huge for Peru. It's absolutely massive. They've definitely been ones left behind. So a few things that make, I think, like Pedro Castillo kind of endearing or popular among a large electorate is his very down-to-earth kind of demeanor. So very kind of authentic way in which he presents himself. He went to vote on a horse. he showed up to vote on a horse, which I think is like a great sort of publicity stunt. A lot of people would find that kind of very, yeah, authentic. And he was part of the Ronderos, which is critics would call Ronderos a vigilante group, but they're more of like a community policing group in the north of the country, which was quite, it's steeped in controversy because these are local peasants who took it upon themselves to protect their land from incursions from organized crime, for example, but also to fight back against large landholders who would sometimes encroach on peasants' land. And he was part, you know, he's proudly part of this community police of the north of the country. So it's definitely not a traditional kind of route for a politician in Peru. Something I forgot to mention though is part of his like policies. He's you know, why it is that that people have called him like part of the far left. So one of the policies he's espoused is to nationalize the country's natural resources to help pay for public services. He's promised to make the highest courts of Peru nationally, like the highest positions in courts, the judges, elected positions, which would be a first for Latin America. And he's also proposing a new constitution where he hopes to modify the articles surrounding the protection of the kind of free market in Peru. Not that he's openly espoused like abolishing the free market, right? But he says that the free market should be enshrined in the constitution as working for development and social and social goods, like for society to profit off the free market, rather than just like enshrining free market protection.
I understand as well that he's kind of to some extent praised like the Maduro regime and Fidel Castro as well. So that's obviously kind of linking into a kind of Latin American kind of far left movement.
Yeah, that's right. There was a famous interview where he said that Venezuela is a I don't know. He said, I don't know what the adjective was, prosperous or well functioning. Or authentic, but then the second adjective was democracy. so yes, he is of that kind of very Cold War sort of left in Latin America, very old fashioned.
And his party, the Free Peru, does that enjoy much of an independent existence other than him? Is this an established party or?
Yeah, it had been polling quite. I mean, it hadn't. I think it never garnered more than like 9% of the vote. But it has been around for a while, and you know it calls itself a Marxist party, but it has been around for a while. I don't actually remember how long it's been around for, but at least the last two elections.
Which, two elections for Peru is a long-lived party.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure, actually, when it's fun, but it's definitely not a very old party. Like, there are some old parties in Peru, like Acción Popular, which has been around for, like, 70 years. But yeah, as we said, most parties aren't around very long.
Yeah.
So, actually, Free Peru describes itself as a Marxist-Leninist Mariateguista party. Mariategui is a famous Peruvian Marxist writer, scholar from the early 20th century, who wrote like the Seven Theses on the Seven Theses, which is his famous book. So people in Peru would know that reference.
Okay. And what about who's going to be his opponent in the second round? It's Keiko Fujimori. So obviously is the daughter of the Peru's president, Alberto Fujimori, from the 1990s, who has a reputation, to say the least. Could you tell us a little bit about kind of what her positions are? Because the impression that I get is that we couldn't have really have picked two of the more polar apart candidates to go into the second round.
Yeah, absolutely. Keiko Fujimori is like the polar opposite to Pedro Castillo when it comes to economic policy. Her party and herself, they espouse like very free market solutions. She's very much obviously associated to her father's legacy and has, and which is one of extreme neoliberalism and what was called in the 1990s the economic shock doctrine to control hyperinflation, which basically meant enormous amounts of austerity and the cutting back of public services and also the privatization of all of the state-owned enterprises in Peru. And she and Keiko Fujimori espouses that sort of very free trade economic agenda. She's also made a lot about being very tough on crime and actually said that she would run a portmanteau. She said, you know, she envisaged Peru as a demodura, which is a portmanteau of democracy and iron fist. So basically, very clear on, and you know, what candidates mean when they say being tough on crime. So, you know, using the coercive capacities of the state in a more kind of extensive fashion to create, I don't know, to achieve the government's goals. She's run for president three times. In 2011, 2016, she also ran for president, and she got into the second round of voting. Both of those times, though, she lost. It's not so clear that that will happen this time around, because last time she faced more centrist, more center-left wing candidates who could kind of tap into also the, I guess, kind of more moderate voters. And it's unclear if Pedro Castillo will be able to do that. Keiko Fujimori, I think, was also famous. I mean, she's been around politics in Peru for forever. She's famous because she became the first minister, the acting first lady of Peru in the 1990s when her father divorced her mother. She went back to Peru from the US where she was studying, I think, business administration. And she served as the acting first lady of Peru in official events and other sort of things. Then more recently, since 2016, she ran for president, but she was also elected to Congress. Which I didn't know could happen. And she became the leader of the majority in Congress, and she made life impossible for the president, PPK. And she's basically, she spearheaded the movement that impeached PPK and then Vizcarra from Congress. And she got a lot of, I think that was a very, that ultimately resulted in a very unpopular and kind of a backlash against her and her party. She already has a huge amount of negative votes because of her association to her father, but also her party and herself is credited for being one of the major parts of the political instability that's been rocking Peru. In addition to which, of course, she's been as I mentioned earlier, she's been in jail three times in connection with cases of corruption. And actually, the cases for which she's been put into jail, although she hasn't been charged with anything, are also the same cases that she used, the same case, the Odebrecht case, which she used to initiate impeachment proceedings against PPK. So how convoluted can it get? She's been bitten by the same snake that she accused others of being poisoned by. She's also, curiously enough, and promised to end COVID lockdowns, which I guess is, we've seen other kind of far-right politicians also use that as a kind of throw out there as a kind of populist strategy for getting votes, just saying that there will be no more COVID lockdowns. What else is there to say of her? She's a recent opinion poll suggested before the electoral results came out, suggested that 55% of Peruvians would never vote for her, which is the reason why she lost the runoff in 2011, 2016. She has a hard kind of nucleus of support, which is probably around 14%, 13%, which is the percent of votes that she got, which she was able to expand in 2011, 2016, but not enough to win the election. If that poll were to be redone after the election, I'm unsure of whether or not 55% of Peruvians would still have that sort of kind of negative vote, negative opinion of her, or if that would be diminished given the context. There were other candidates as well. I think, so it's just worth mentioning, like Rafael Lopez of the Popular Renovation, who was the third place, a third place that was very close to the fourth place, actually. He's a right-wing candidate who called himself proudly the Bolsonaro of Peru. So I think that says a lot about him. Then there was the candidate who ended up in fourth place, called Hernando de Soto of the party Avanza País, which means like the country advances. He's an internationally famous economist. I think he's probably maybe some of our listeners know him as the author of The Mystery of Capital, which is this book about property rights. It's the subtitle is Why Capitalism Triumphs in the West but Fails Everywhere Else, which is a book espousing, you're basically saying that property rights, if they're well taken care of by a country, even by a third world country or a developing country, will promote the informal economy, the informal sector, and make it a motor of development. He's hugely famous as a kind of academic he's also written some popular books, but his legacy in Peru is not so much associated with his international fame as it is with the fact that he was part of Fujimori's cabinet. And he was one of the people who espoused and who came up with the economic shock doctrine, which, as I told the audience, was about keeping hyperinflation down, but at an extremely high cost, at the cost of enormous precarity and kind of diminishing the capacity for the state to actually kind of direct development. And I think, at the time, it seems like the only viable solution, but I think now a lot of people have turned back against neoliberalism's kind of most extreme policies, and this was definitely one of them. He's socially liberal, and it's telling that he didn't win much of the votes anywhere except for Lima. So he's very much a candidate of kind of the kind of urban, probably middle, upper middle classes. He got a little over 10% of the vote. And then there were a total of 18 candidates. So we won't go one by one through them because that would just take way too long. But it's significant that there were 18 candidates because and the vote was extremely kind of fragmented. And there was a combination of more established parties like popular action with very kind of new parties like Free Peru, which ended up in first place. There was also a lot of politicians who had been around for a very long time. So I think most of the presidential candidates, other than Pedro Castillo, would appear for regular Peruvians as kind of more of the same. They kind of identify them with party politics, either because they've held positions before, or because they come, or they're related to people who've already been in power at some point.
So, what about the congressional elections? Did they follow more or less the same kind of vote shares as their candidates in the presidential election for the parties, or was there a bit of a kind of incongruence between the two?
Yeah, I think that they did mostly follow the presidential vote. So like Free Peru got 37 seats out of 130, and which is Castillo's party, and then Fujimori's party, which is Fuerza Popular, got 24 seats, in contrast to, or compared with 13.3% of the vote that she got for as a presidential candidate. And then I guess there was a little bit of a discrepancy after that, because Acción Popular, which was Acción Popular got 17 seats in Congress, but their candidate, Johnny Lescano, was only got 9% of the vote and is positioned at number five. I guess there was a kind of discrepancy after the first and second place. The parties that ended up in Congress do have don't necessarily match the percentage of votes that the candidates got in the presidential election, and that could be partly because of sophisticated voting or like splitting the ticket, but also partly because of the multi-member constituency voting that happens at the congressional level, which is proportional representation, but it's not, you know, it's not perfect proportional representation, partially because the constituencies have variable numbers of seats to them. So most of the constituencies have around, I think, I forgot the number, but they're around like three seats, I think, each of the 27 constituencies.
Yeah, it's telling, just from eyeballing the results, it looks to me as if parties that are kind of broadly in the closer to the center, like We Are Peru, National Victory, and the Purple Party, seem to have done better in the legislative part of the election than in the presidential election. I wonder if that's kind of possibly a mix of people possibly in the presidential election kind of strategically trying to vote for candidates who they think are kind of more distinctive, and then kind of trying to vote for something that's maybe a little bit more consensual for the congressional election. But it's hard to kind of, given how insanely complex the political scene is in Peru, just try and come to kind of easy conclusions about this stuff.
Yeah, and I wanted to return to something that you said, Chris, before we started recording, actually, which is just noting that so many candidates, six candidates got around 10% of the vote. Castillo got close to 20, but another five got around 10%-ish of the vote in the runoff. And that shows a lot of social fragmentation, but it also creates the possibility of surprises, like Pedro Castillo, who's intensely popular in some regions, partially because he stands out as a kind of indigenous peasant outsider candidate, it opens the door for that sort of surprises.
Yeah, and it's also always suggestive of, you know, the more parties you have, having more parties means that there's less distance between individual candidates. And so the more parties you have, typically the more volatile things happen because people have kind of more places to go to in terms of where they could potentially vote. So it does tend to make polling less reliable, and also it means that people are probably likelier to switch their vote. One thing that's kind of jumps out is Mendoza, who is another kind of radical left candidate, was leading, I think, in a lot of the polls beforehand, and has ended up in thick for only about 8% of the vote, as I understand it. You can clearly imagine that a lot of votes have been taken out of her by Castillo, as who's on the rise.
I wonder if part of the fact that his rise was not seen by polls is to do with the areas in which he's getting like most of his support, which tend to be like remote, mountainous, mainly Quechua speaking, and it may be harder to poll. And just kind of like the support he had.
That's potentially true, and you know it's always more difficult to poll in countries like Peru. So it might be the case that that's so to some extent, yeah. But yeah, it's tricky to know. The quality of Peruvian polling is not something that I'm particularly okay with. But it's always harder to poll countries that are where with lower levels of literacy, with more remote populations that kind of might be hard to reach, with kind of big language divides, all of which exist in Peru. And with more fragmented political system, party systems, which is also very it's always basically harder to predict elections the more candidates there are. is essentially a good truism from anywhere.
So I have two speculative questions for you, Andres, to end on, if you don't mind. The first is, if you to take a bet, who will win the second round? And also, is there an institutional design that you think could bring stability to Peru?
Whoa, that's, two really, really hard questions. Castillo having won this first round makes it much more likely that Keiko will win the presidency. Third time's the charm. She has like a lot of negative, a lot of people have, you know, a lot of Peruvians would never vote for Fujimori or said that they would never vote for Fujimori. They had a relatively easy choice between her and a candidate like PPK, for example, who's the last president who won an election, who could moderate much more easily, more plausibly. And PPK was actually quite very much of a moderate, kind of center left, with some kind of free trade positions as well. So Keiko, I think, might find it, despite the past that she has to contend with, she might find it easier to moderate, make it to the center, make the case for center votes. And just kind of a sign of this was that Vargas Llosa, Vargas Llosa is like the Nobel Prize winner of Peruvian fiction, a towering figure in Spanish literature all around the world, and also a presidential candidate who lost against Fujimori, and he's been an anti-Fujimori character for a very long time, criticizing authoritarianism. And he thinks of himself as a kind of classical 19th century liberal, right? He came out in an interview and said that Keiko Fujimori is the better of the two candidates, which might be telling about where kind of the center right will vote, and what a lot of maybe kind of urban, like proven urbanites might vote, who they might vote for. But again, I don't, given that, I think Pedro Castillo's party would find it hard to present a kind of moderating kind of centrist position for the second round, but I'm not sure about him as a person. And we've seen very little of him beyond this campaign. We just know about his kind of past as a kind of, organizing a school teacher's strike, but we don't know about his kind of his abilities as a politician. And Keiko, we do know that she's, you know, she's a quite skillful politician. So it's a hard question to ask. If I had to bet, I would very reluctantly, because I really don't like her, but very reluctantly probably say that Keiko Fujimori will win.
Yeah, it's worth saying that my understanding is that second round polls beforehand showed Fujimori losing by a lot to every candidate, included, albeit I don't think Castillo was amongst the candidates that were polled. But for example, she was losing like 75 to 25 against some of the more moderate candidates, but she was going as even against Mendoza, the kind of most radical of the left-wing candidates, apart from Castillo, even amongst, she was still winning 60-40, albeit, you know, there's always some concern around how accurate polling might be in these situations. Campaigns can change things, blah, 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 blah. But obviously, Castillo being so radical does impose, and so unknown, does impose some further tension. I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, it's a very tough question. Very hard to tell, actually. And regardless of who wins, they're going to face the same problems that their predecessor faced, which is a system that is, at the moment, mimicking and maybe even exaggerating social divisions within the country. And so this goes to your second question about the institutional setup. I do think that impeachment can't. So there's two large sources of instability. One is the institutional setup and the fact that Congress can so easily impeach the president, but also the fact that Congress needs to approve the president's cabinet. In a kind of regular kind of presidential system, Congress only needs to approve certain very kind of specific members of the executive branch, like, I don't know, ambassadors or in the United States, I think it's the Attorney General, if I'm not mistaken. In Peru, it's all of the cabinet, which really puts a lot of pressure on the president. And although that one could think that those are incentives for cooperation between the branches, they've actually become part of like a bargaining chip between the presidency and in Congress. So I would, I would probably not include that possibility if I could redesign the Peruvian constitution, which might happen if Pedro Castillo wins. Not that I would redesign it, but that Peruvians would get a chance to vote on its redesign. I would probably scrap that rule, along with the easy impeachment and the figure of moral incapacity, which is just open to interpretation. The other source of instability is the fact that Peru's system, like justice system, and it's kind of the same case as in Brazil and in Colombia, actually. Its justice system is more independent than politicians are ready for. And so politicians are involved in corruption scandals and they get put in jail or they get caught by a relatively kind of autonomous, kind of high capacity justice system, which is, for example, something that doesn't happen in Mexico. I mean, in Mexico, there have been basically no convictions for Odebrecht. And the presidential candidate at the time, who most likely received money from Odebrecht, is totally, you know, scotch-free, right? So that's another source of instability. And that's a much kind of harder question to answer because it's, you know, Latin America, there's just so many incentives to be corrupt. But if they get caught and there's no resolution to it, that creates a huge amount of instability. Maybe instability for that reason is a good sort of instability, while instability for based on kind of an awkward positioning of institutional incentives is kind of the wrong instability. I don't know. I'm making up that theory right now. It's just a hypothesis.
Yeah, you'd hope that in the long term, politicians would learn from having an independent justice system that maybe it's best not to be corrupt. But, you know, that's not always how things work out. It feels to me like the Peruvian constitution almost to some extent falls between two stools of being either a kind of more traditional presidential system or being a semi-presidential system. And the way out may be just to kind of go for one or the other to some extent. I don't particularly like presidential systems, and I don't think they particularly perform well in Latin America. But it strikes me that it's possibly a bit better than what Peru has now. Albeit, I do kind of wonder if other parties might be so willing, particularly when you've got like elections like this, which generate kind of two very controversial candidates, to empower the presidency further. But maybe if a kind of way out might be that if Castillo so wants to change the constitution, perhaps the kind of parts that he's more concerned about the free market could be weakened in exchange for moving to something that's more like a semi-presidential system. And that might, you can see how that would work for Congress. But I don't know if that's, I don't know enough about him to know whether that's a compromise he might be willing to take. Having spoken about one very fascinating, complex election in the South American Andes. In the Andes, because that's the only Andes. Having spoken about one election in the Andes region of Latin America, we'll now move on to another fascinating election. We spoke about this one when the first round happened, which was a whole 2 months ago. We released that episode on the 14th of February. So if you want a little bit more about this, and you either haven't listened to that episode or you would like to go back and listen to it again, please do go back through your podcast subscriptions and give that one a go. We are now talking about Ecuador, which is a very interesting election in terms of the essentially became a referendum of sorts on the legacy of the former presidency of Rafael Correa, between Correa's favoured candidate Aruz and a right-wing candidate by the name of Lasso, and which despite a clear majority of votes for the left in the first round, has now seen Lasso elected the president of Ecuador. Let's quickly flick on to our Latin America expert Andreas once again, who we're leaning on a lot this episode, and just say, so Andreas, what seems to be the main reasons driving this seemingly surprising outcome?
Right. I think the main reason, I mean, the immediate cause is the fact that there were so many spoiled ballots. So the fact that so many people who voted for the third place in the Well, maybe not only the spoiled ballots, but the fact that so I think one of the reasons for this is that the fact that the people who voted for the third place of the first round, whose name is Yaku Perez of the party Pachakuti, could not bring themselves to vote for Arauz, despite the fact that they were on the left. And so they either spoiled their ballot, and spoiled ballots broke a record in Ecuador with, it was 1.7 million spoiled ballots in the second round, which is close to 16% of spoiled ballots, right? And then a lot of them possibly voted for Guillermo Lasso, but surely most of them did not vote for Arauz. So there's a big divide in the Ecuadorian left that was that could not be bridged between Correa's candidate Arauz and the second most important left-wing candidate, whose name is Yaku Perez. We spoke about him in the 14th February episode. He's an anti-extractivist, indigenous, eco-socialist, who is in direct opposition to Correa because he was imprisoned during Correa's presidency for having led a protest against, I think it was the construction of a dam. So I think that's one of the main reasons. The other reason is, of course, that Correa is highly controversial and has a lot of, you know, his presidency, although it enjoyed economic growth on the one hand, also saw a lot of repression of, for example, indigenous groups, a kind of anti-free speech law. And then by the end was mired in scandals of corruption. And in fact, Correa himself could not run as vice president to Arauz, which was originally his plan, because he has an open investigation against him in Ecuador's by Ecuador's attorney general because of a corruption scandal, so he can't run. So and that also definitely put off a lot of people to his candidate. I guess maybe I guess possibly a third reason is the fact that Arauz, who is carrying the kind of the legacy of Correa for the worst it turned out for him, although there are some people in Ecuador who are, you know, quite loyal to Correa and the Correista movement. I think one of the reasons was that Arauz was not able to position himself as flexibly as kind of moving towards the center as Lasso was. So Lasso himself, you know, Lasso's run for president already, I think, twice. He was the Minister of the Economy for the president of Ecuador in the late 90s, again, part of the kind of neoliberal reforms that ended up having Ecuador adopt the dollar. So Lasso is part of that legacy. And he was able to kind of skillfully maybe push that legacy to one side and present. He's also part of the Opus Dei, a virulently kind of conservative movement within the Catholic Church or Catholic movement. And he, you know, he pandered to or not, I don't know if pandered, but he tried to present himself as having moderated his position, as having become less extreme in his Catholic values. So, for example, his vice president publicly said sorry for having supported conversion therapy for gay people, for example. Lasso also said that he was a feminist, right? I don't find those declarations very credible coming from his history and the fact that he's kind of been staunchly anti-abortion and or anti-pro-choice and also like virulently anti-LGBT. But some people did, I guess what I've been reading is that he did seem to be kind of more plausibly moving towards the center. You, Chris, you had a really interesting hypothesis about also why some people might be, some people who didn't vote for either of these two candidates in the first round might have voted for them in the second round, might have voted for Lasso predominantly.
Yeah, so one thing that's kind of clear in both rounds is that there's a sizable number of spoiled ballots, about 1.3 million in the first round, 1.9 million in the second round. And obviously it's clear that it's clear to some extent that other left-wing supporters were moving into that spoiled ballot area. But it might be the case, possibly, that some of the people who voted before it spoiled their ballot in the first round might have gone to Lasso in the second, because those people are presumably to some extent largely anti-system and possibly Aruz, as the career candidate, is seen as kind of more it seems it more objectionable for the kind of controversial legacy that has. Some of them may kind of broadly be people who are on the centre-right and who weren't, you know, particularly enamoured with Lasso in the first round, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. I think an important thing to just note is, I mean, Lasso won the second round, so he'll become the president of Ecuador with about 4.5 million votes. And Arauz got 4.1 million votes. The spoiled ballots were 1.7. So there's about, you know, the spoiled ballots were more than four times larger than the difference between the first and second place in this second round of voting. Also worth noting, voting is mandatory in Ecuador. So if you're between 18 and 65, you get a $40 fine for not showing up to vote if you don't have a valid excuse, which includes like travel abroad. But so, you know, as a rule, you would have to end up paying $40, which in Ecuador is a lot. I mean, that's really a lot of money. That's more than people make in a day's worth of work. It's probably what people make in probably 2 or 3 days of work for not showing up to vote. So people have a very large, very powerful incentive to show up to vote, which is why we had an 82% turnout. But if they are unconvinced voters, if they're reluctant voters, you still have to show up to vote. I mean, it makes sense why there would be so many spoiled ballots. But there's still even more spoiled ballots this time around than there's ever been before. And Yaku Perez, the third place, actually called for ballots to be spoiled because he said that there had been fraud in the first round when he lost to Lasso by about 0.3% of the vote. Although we must note that there were multiple recounts of several polling stations that Yaku Perez had kind of said that where there had been fraud, and the results basically didn't move. They moved in the kind of 0.02 realm, which means that the electoral management body in Ecuador is extremely proficient, like impeccable electoral administration. Also, the speed at which the second round was counted was incredible. They had like full results by the end of Sunday, and they're all hand counted. So props to the CNE, which is the electoral management body of Ecuador. It's really highly professional.
It's worth saying, though, that having a candidate advocate a blank vote is always an interesting thing, because it might not just mean that their voters vote blank, because it reminds other voters that that option exists. So people don't always remember, even though it is an option that exists, that this is something that they can do. There was a really interesting study I read on voter administration, I think in Brazil, where basically they introduced voting machines and the way that the UI was set up was that the very first question you got asked when you turned the machine on, when you came to vote, was, do you want to cast a vote for a candidate or do you want to cast a vote for a blank vote? And obviously what then happened was blank votes went up because voters went, oh yeah, I can do that and not vote for any of these people I hate without even looking at the list of candidates. So if you go about reminding people that they can blank vote, even if for non-reasons, perhaps not related to the reasons you're doing it, it will sometimes just encourage people to cast them. Regardless.
That's an excellent point. That's a really good point. I think one thing, I looked into this and I couldn't find a study that's yet out or kind of a poll that could give us kind of more light into how votes from the first round translated into votes in the second round. What I saw, and this is kind of partly based on one opinion poll that I did see about the fourth candidate votes going to Arauz, plus some speculation, is there was already 1 million spoiled ballots in the first round. There were 1.7 in the second round. Betis got 1.7 as well. But not all of the people who voted for Betis heeded to his call, as you rightly say, Chris. Some of them probably did go to Lasso. And then you had the fourth candidate, who's Javier Hervás, who is part of the left democracy. And I, even though the leaders of left democracy said that they wouldn't support Arauz, I think probably a lot of his voters went for him. But that's kind of my take. It's partial speculation, but we see you know, the effects of the two-round system.
But it does kind of big questions about where it was that these Lasso votes came from, because Lasso got into the second round very narrowly and was a good 13% of the vote behind Arauz. So it's not just that he's gained votes between rounds. He's gained more votes than Arauz from a much lower base. He's literally gone from 1.8 million votes to 4.6 million, which, and like we've spoken broadly about four candidates. The other, even if you got every single vote beyond the other three candidates who are all left wing, it wouldn't be enough to add up to it. So, yeah, there's clearly some level of churn and division going on below the surface.
Yeah. The only the way I think of kind of like looking at this, and obviously you have to bear everything else we've said in mind as well, but of the provinces which voted for Perez in the first round, all but one of them voted for Lasso in the second round as well. We've obviously no way of knowing if those quite the same voters, but it seems that we could speculate that a decent chunk of Perez voters went over. Unusually, Lasso also won the only province which Hervás won in the first round as well, which is like slightly unusual. But yeah, it seems he basically, because in the first round, Lasso only won one province and seemed like most of his support was very regionally focused. But whereas this time, he's not won over any of the areas which vote for Arauz. Is basically just they seem to have taken over most of Perez's areas.
Yeah, and which, I mean, although they're very different candidates from completely opposite ends of the political spectrum, I mean, Perez is in many ways to the left of the careerists. They share a commonality in very strong discourses against careerist corruption. And as well, it's worth remembering it's been a long time between rounds, 2 months, which gives people a lot of time to change position and to kind of reconsider how they voted in the first round. And obviously there have been events during that time as well.
Yeah. And you see a very clear geographic divide, right? The kind of the west of Ecuador went for Arauz and the east basically went for Lasso, largely speaking, with the exception of one small province in the north.
Is that a typical Ecuadorian political divide, or is it
It's my understanding that those are the coastal provinces, and they do have a slightly different kind of makeup identity. Mm. Same thing that happens in Bolivia, where you get like the country split by the Andes, and there's so like the lowlands tend to vote for actually one party, or they have a higher proportion of one party, and the highlands have a higher proportion of the MAS, Evo Morales's party, and it's split.
Which I mean, given that Perez was broadly an indigenous candidate, kind of like Morales is, that's telling therefore that Lasso is the one who's won those to some extent.
It's kind of fascinating that we ended up with like one there was a majority of left voting Ecuadorians in the first round, and they ended up with a right-wing president. It's also a country with a high kind of indigenous population, and the candidate that ended up voting is very white. You'd definitely be considered white in the Ecuadorian context, versus Arauz, who is more kind of like what we'd call mestizo, more kind of dark-skinned, mixed heritage. The ironies of coalition building and
as well, we should probably mention that there was some controversy around Arauz during the election, because it was claimed, I believe, in the Colombian press that Arauz was receiving funding from a Colombian paramilitary group. Of course, Ecuador borders Colombia, so and there's some controversy over whether this is obviously there's a controversy over whether the fact it's true, but there's also a controversy over whether it might be untrue on the basis that it might be represent a kind of form of Colombian electoral intervention in Ecuadorian elections.
Yeah, no, just a small that's totally true, with the exception you said paramilitary, and anywhere else in the world I think paramilitary would work for the organization that's accused of funding the campaign, but in Colombia paramilitary is associated with armed groups that are pro-state, pro-government, especially by Uribe. This would be the guerrilla group. They have in Colombia, they have two categories, like armed guerrilla group and paramilitary. And
yes.
They're like two sides of it.
You're completely correct to correct me on that. It's the classic freedom fighter, rebel terrorist, revolutionary. But yeah, these things have very different meanings in different parts of the world.
Exactly. The second thing to note, just before we wrap up very quickly, is that Lasso is now in the awkward position that he's won. And I say this with full irony, because it's very awkward. He has only 12 seats in Congress. His party has only 12 seats in Congress out of 137. There's a majority of left-leaning voters overall in Ecuador, from what we can tell from first round voting. And he is committed to very kind of free trade, neoliberal policies.
Yeah.
And he has basically no support in Congress. Yeah. So
I mean, there is an irony as well that officially he was running as a kind of joint party candidate, and the other party has won more seats than his did. But that's, that still leaves him with a even with between those two, and that's uncomfortable too, because it means that he's in some senses got to be more attentive to the needs of his junior coalition partner than to the needs of his own party.
But Creo actually lost seats in the end.
Whereas the other party, the Social Christian Party, actually gained a few. But that that leaves him overall between them. They have 30 seats in the 130 seat parliament. 137 seat Congress, which is not an easy position to govern from.
Yeah, and the three left wing parties, the largest left wing parties together, have 94 seats. I just did the maths really quickly, and these were the three most voted parties in the congressional elections as well. They came first, second, and third, all parties of the left.
So we've kind of ended up talking in this episode about two different elections where we've ended up with presidents or likely presidents up against very difficult congresses. It's worth saying as well that the in the congressional elections, which happened alongside the first round, the invalid votes were even higher for Congress than they were for the presidency. That was a full quarter of the vote. So the extent to which this Congress might be seen as legitimate is also probably going to be an issue to moving forwards. That's fun.
It's one thing to win, it's another to govern when you have a divided
government. We had a little conversation before we recorded this episode as well about whether it might be the case that some people explicitly voted for Lasso with the full knowledge that he might be going up against the divided Congress, and the idea that therefore he might not be their favourite candidate, but that would kind of hem him in a way that would be less so for a ruse, albeit hemming in presidential candidates is something that often produces a fair number of instability, a fair amount of instability, so it's not necessarily the best thing for the country.
Does either of you know what the... obviously, we've spoken about Peru as being... having a very powerful legislature versus the presidency. Does anyone know what the kind of balance of power is in Ecuador between the National Assembly and the president?
Good question. I would suspect I don't recall it being different from like just regular presidential systems. So like yes, there is the possibility of impeachment, but it's much higher, right? You need a higher proportion of votes, and there isn't the I don't think that there's a figure akin to moral incapacity, which is basically whatever the Congress decides it is. And there's definitely not the approving of cabinet positions.
I don't know off the top of my head, but one of the ironies here is that it's not just the case that Correa was president for a long time. He also essentially wrote this constitution. This is a constitutional design that was designed for Korea. And with that in mind, I kind of do wonder the extent to which, knowing really nothing more than the basics about Ecuadorian constitutional design, the extent to which it's been designed for kind of Korea's style of politics, and therefore it might actually feature a pretty powerful presidency, even by Latin American standards. I mean, it's obviously been designed for a certain style of politics, and it will now be, it's now going to be interesting watching it tested by possibly a very different style of politics.
Lucky for us, there is the Parliamentary Powers Index, which I just Googled. But it is out there. And, you know, so good let's plan. See. It scores Peru on 0.66. I have no idea what this is made out of. It's probably in Ecuador with 0.5. I have no idea how this the methodology behind this coding, but you know, it might be interesting to look into.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I guess if it's towards 0.5, that and Peru is at 0.66, that probably indicates that probably indicates a much more less powerful legislature. Although, albeit to what extent, is probably a big question. I mean, 0.5 seems to put it on a par with, say, Argentina, which is a very powerful presidency, as I understand it. And 0.44 is Bolivia, which is similar. Yeah, Brazil is 0.56.
Yeah, from what I can see in this index, everything above 0.6 is basically a parliamentary system, with the exception of Peru. But I'm just eyeballing it, which, you know, is close to what we've been saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's telling in a bunch of ways. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is gonna be interesting to see this pan out.
It was great recording this, you guys.
Yeah, not too many weeks now as well until we get to do an episode on an election in one of our countries as well.
Yes.
Quite soon. Yeah, coming up, the big UK electoral bonanza.
The UK electoral bonanza, which may well end up requiring multiple episodes because of how many things we're electing in the country.